hands with Helen of Troy. We did, however, enjoy the less forbidden pleasures of Simon Callow, Mark Ravenhill, and John Rowe. So please, in the time you have left, do show your appreciation for them.
And welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Rob Cowan. In the second half of tonight's prom, there's just one work, which is both a symphony and a celebration of a composer who I always think of as scandalously underappreciated, or more accurately, widely celebrated for all the wrong reasons. His name, Franz Liszt, born 200 years ago this year, and whose range of invention stretches from finger-twisting piano showpieces to the stark pre-modernist statements of his later years. Liszt was one of the few composers who made the full pilgrimage from earthly to spiritual love, and you could say that what we're about to hear in a moment or two, his Faust Symphony, makes that journey manifest in a single work.
Liszt was more than just a very brilliant figure of his time. We are dealing with a piece of almost timeless dimensions, and certainly the meaning of this piece for the music of the 19th and 20th century is enormous.
It's almost as if it's philosophy without words, isn't it? Because you have the conflict between good and evil, you have the element of love which is central, so there are messages you can pick up from this music. I know there's the chorus Mysticus at the end, which brings in words and brings in a beautiful message, but there is so much that it actually says without using words at all.
I would call it Nietzsche called Wagner's Tristan Opus Metaphysicum. I would call this one Opus Metaphysicum, and maybe even Opus Mysticum, because the really mystical and unexplicable thing for me is how Liszt draws all those three diametrally opposed characters, Faust, Margarete, and Mephistopheles, out of one and the same theme. But the miracle is that it works. You do hear the differences between the Faust, between the love of Margarete, Gretchen, and then the devilishness of Mephistopheles. At the same time, it is one and the same thing. So this, for me, is pure metaphysics.
Vladimir Yurovsky, who also pointed out to me that Faust's theme underpins the entire work. It is, in fact, its main motive. And we meet Faust himself first, the philosopher who can't find fulfillment, a man racked by disillusionment and conflict, represented in music that's very much in keeping with Liszt's most passionate symphonic poems. So, in a sense, it's the second movement, a tender portrait of Gretchen, the sweet innocent whose beguiling tone poetry bears a resemblance to Liszt's beautiful symphonic poem Orpheus. And lastly, in this Faust symphony by Liszt, there's the devil in the pack, Mephistopheles himself, the trickster, shadowy, unpredictable, quixotic, and the inspiration behind what's probably the symphony's most inventive music. Interesting that according to Goethe, the devil can't create, only destroy. So Liszt doesn't actually give him any original themes. He just takes Faust's themes, then twists and mutilates them into distorted parodies to show Mephistopheles actually acting through Faust. But although Faust is discomfited, he's not defeated, and a sudden transition elevates us to the a cappella chorus Mystica, heralded by the organ, and where a tenor soloist, Marco Jentsch, in tonight's performance, enters with the Gretchen motive, the message being that all things are transitory. Well, here at the Hall, a very interesting and impressive spectacle. The men of the London Symphony Chorus and the London Philharmonic Choir, 50 or so on the stage and another 120 ranged on the tiers behind, about 160, 170 altogether. And now the applause here at the Royal Albert Hall for the conductor, Vladimir Yurovsky, who together with the tenor Marco Jentsch, the men's voices of the London Symphony Chorus and the London Philharmonic Choir and the London Philharmonic Orchestra perform Liszt's A Faust Symphony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
that is past of us was but reflected, all that was lost in us here is corrected, all indescribables here we descry it, woman's divinity leads us on high. Lewis McNeice translation of Goethe's Faust. And that was Liszt's orchestral masterpiece, his Faust Symphony. The tenor soloist was Marco Jentsch, with the men of the London Symphony Chorus and the London Philharmonic Choir, and the London Philharmonic Orchestra, under their principal conductor, Vladimir Yurovsky. What I found so beautiful about that performance was the control of line that Yurovsky displayed in all the quieter music, especially Gretchen, the middle movement, and the drama was magnificently projected, I thought. Impressive orchestral discipline from the members of the London Philharmonic, and such wonderful principals as well. Ian Hardwick, oboe, the guest principal viola, Tom Dunn, trumpet, Paul Beniston, Peter Schumann, of course, the leader, and Nicholas Carpenter, clarinet. And here Neville Creed, who directed the choruses, takes a bow. And here is Marco Jentsch. Huge chap, very imposing. He claps and applauds the choir himself. And Vladimir Yurovsky returns, triumphant in this music. Not an easy work to pull together, as great as it is. But he certainly managed. Principal strings are asked to stand. They did such lovely work. And he cues various principal woodwinds that I've just mentioned, and players from the orchestra. Well, a very memorable prom. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. On Monday night, you can hear Liszt's other great symphony on a literary theme, his Dante Symphony, with the BBC Philharmonic under their outgoing principal conductor, Gianandrea Noseda. A programme that also includes music by Beethoven and Saint-Saëns' Egyptian Piano Concerto. But now, time to hand you back to Jill Anderson at Broadcasting House for the rest of this evening's listening.
Thank you very much. That was Rob Cowan at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Radio 3. And I should also mention that Liszt is our Composer of the Week this week, and you can hear the next episode of that programme tomorrow at noon, repeated at 6:30. Well, we've two programmes about opera this evening. At 10:45 in the essay, Matt Peacock, originator of the community opera project Streetwise, reflects on the way opera's changed the lives of people he's met during the past 10 years. But now, in tonight's feature on Radio 3, the musician Claire Van Kampen goes on a journey back to the beginnings of the operatic tradition in England. The setting is unlikely. The country has been ravaged by civil war. The king has been beheaded, and the theatres have all been closed by order of the Puritan Parliament. Step forward Sir William Davenant, cavalier rake and political opportunist, to mount the first English opera.
If you ask people, what's the first English opera? They'll probably say John Blow's Venus and Adonis, or Henry Purcell's Dido and Aeneas. Good answers, but both wrong. In fact, England's first opera was The Siege of Rhodes, and it was performed publicly more than two decades earlier, in 1656. It's an amazing story. especially when you consider that the work's librettist, Sir William Davenant, was a fervent royalist and the theatres had officially been closed for more than a decade when it was first performed. How did such a seminal event come to pass under Oliver Cromwell's supposedly anti-dramatic republic? That's one of the questions I want to try to answer. And it brings centre stage one of the great forgotten heroes of the English theatre, William Davenant. Some might say Davenant was the man who invented not only English opera, but also the idea of William Shakespeare, the national poet. Another question I want to address is, what did the Siege of Rhodes actually sound like? I'm particularly interested in this because I spent many years exploring Renaissance stage music at Shakespeare's Globe. I'll be meeting up with some of the country's finest opera singers to see if we can resurrect the musical spirit of the siege. It's the first time that's been attempted since Samuel Pepys tried it, almost 350 years ago. The score to the Siege of Rhodes has long been lost, but we know enough about the musical context and the composers involved to perhaps get a flavour of what they were up to.
Still a new plot, or at least an old trick. We English were wont to be simple and true, but every man now is a Florentine nick. A little Peugeot for a great Richelieu.
1642 was a watershed year for English dramatists. The theatres were closed down, and playwrights like William Davenant, by then poet laureate, found themselves out of a job. One of the great opponents of the theatre, and another key player in our story, was Oliver Cromwell, whose rise to political eminence swept away so many traditional pastimes of 17th century Britain. To find out a bit more about the impact Cromwell's ascent had on Davenant and other artists, I travelled to Cromwell's house, which is now a museum, in Ely, to speak to Dr. Dawn Lewcock, who has studied Davenant over many years.
Though the theatres had been closed, there were still some players in London, and they would open up the Red Bull. Occasionally they'd have a troop of soldiers burst in, take them all off to the guardhouse, and there are reports of them being dragged through the streets in their costumes to the mockery of the general public. But they still tried, bless them. Cromwell liked music. He had concerts in his own house. It was the actual drama, the plays, that the Puritan view was not wicked exactly, but it was feigning something that wasn't true. It was giving people illusions that were wrong, and therefore this was a bad thing to do.
Obviously, the Civil War had a major impact on court writers like Davenant. What happened to him and his peers during this period?
Well, Davenant himself was a gunrunner, actually. He had 14 years away from writing and was an emissary between the king and the queen, and was also fighting up in Yorkshire at a time. But once the regicide happened, he went off to Paris with Henrietta Maria and set to writing his great epic poem, which he never finished, called Gondibert. But then Charles II made him the lieutenant governor of Maryland, which was then an English colony, and he was setting off to go there in a boat in the Channel and was captured by the Commonwealth Navy. Well, I think they had one boat, and was taken back to London and put in the Tower. And it said that he was about to be executed but was saved by John Milton.
How well was he known?
Very well known, actually. He was the poet laureate after Ben Jonson. He'd written some 10 plays and 4 or 5 masks for court. He himself, actually, is a very interesting character because he came from very humble beginnings. He turned up in London aged 16 in 1622 with an inheritance that his father thought was going to be put to giving him an apprenticeship in a trade. Instead of which, he made his way to one of the best tailors in town and bought himself a really good outfit and somehow or other managed to become in the household of the Duchess of Richmond, where he started his long climb into the court circle.
Now, in the 1630s, it was rumoured that Davenant had died. Can you tell me about that?
Well, he disappeared from court for about 3 years, and it's thought he must have had syphilis, and he went and retired to the countryside to get better. We think he must have been treated with mercury The only portrait we've got of him shows him with this funny little snub nose with a break in it, a great dip in it. And he was mocked for this. Oh. Even that late on, in a collection of his poems, where they always put these commentatory poems by his friends at the beginning, and one of them mocks him for this and because he put an apostrophe in his name. Oh. When he started, it was D-A-V-E-N-A-N-T. By his second play, on the title page, he'd got D apostrophe capital A V-E-N-A-N-T.
Davenant.
Davenant, yes. And he said he was probably a Lombard because the play was about Lombardy.
Fantastic.
But this is what the part of the poem said. Some say by Avenant no place is meant, and that this Lombard is without descent. And as by bilk, meaning to bilk your bill, of course, men mean there's nothing there, so come from Avenant means from nowhere. So Will, intending Davenant to grace, has made a notch in's name like in's face.
One of the ways in which Davenant had marked himself out at court prior to the Civil War was as a writer of masks. Might these have shaped his operatic experiments in the 1650s? Martin Butler is Professor of English Renaissance Drama at Leeds University.
Court masks are a form that were historically involved with the princely courts of 16th and 17th century Europe. They were a form of festivity that went hand in hand with the displays of prestige and financial and political power that European princes were keen to promote. Davenant produced a series of masks celebrating King Charles and Henrietta Maria. In his mask Britannia Triumphans, King Charles is introduced in the character of Britannocles, the heroic ruler of Britain. And the final scene shows the British fleet tacking to and fro across a serene sea. And this was an allusion to ship money, the unparliamentary tax that Charles was endeavouring to levy at this time. It's very tempting to think of the Siege of Rhodes as a direct descendant of Davenant's mask writing. In fact, in some ways, it's rather different. Masks were more like variety shows. They didn't tell stories in the complex way that the Siege of Rhodes was to do. However, the key departures in the Siege of Rhodes, that is, the music and particularly the scenery, which was the other aspect of the performance that contemporaries commented on, these were things that Davenant would have been very accustomed to working with in the court mask. And he was also working with a group of people who had been intimately involved in the production of masks. Two of his composers, Charles Coleman and Henry Laws, had written music for masks before the Civil War. The scenery was designed by John Webb, who was Inigo Jones's assistant and who had helped him work on the later masks. And there may even have been money put into it by a lawyer, Sir John Maynard, who was a friend of Davenant's, but who had also written masks himself as a kind of amateur writer in the 1620s.
Having made the short journey from Ely to Cambridge, I'm now in Magdalen College, where I'm about to meet Dr. Richard Luckett, the Pepys librarian. So the reason we're here is that we're on a bit of a treasure trail about the Siege of Rhodes. We're trying to discover the history of it, the roots of it, and eventually what parts of it may have sounded like.
Do come in.
Oh, Dr. Luckett, how nice to meet you. Good afternoon.
So here you are in the Pepys Library with Pepys's books exactly as he wished them to be left at his death.
So what are we looking at here?
We're looking at one of Pepys's songbooks, and these were compiled for him by his domestic musician and reader in foreign tongues, Cesare Morelli. and you will notice the very large.
Yes, it's very large, isn't it? And beautifully, clearly written out with lots of spacing between the notes. Very unlike the way that manuscript of this period often looks. It's very clear.
Absolutely. It's completely different. Mm. And that is because Pepys was having major problems with his eyes.
Yes.
That's why he stopped writing the diary. But he didn't realise that his problem was not so much with his eyes as with his ophthalmologist.
I see.
Who was treating him for short sight when what he was suffering from was mixed astigmatism and yes. long sight. And so here, in amongst Pepys's favourite songs for singing, Maidle Lully, in fact, there is his own song, which is Beauty Retire and is a setting from the Siege of Rhodes.
Yes, I'm reading the label here. It says Beauty Retire, Diary, 6th of December, 1665. I spent the afternoon upon a song of Soliman's words to Roxolana that I have set.
Retire, thou dost my pity move. Believe my pity and then trust my love. At first I thought her by our prophet sent.
Can you explain a little more about the connection between them? Was it just an admiration of Davenant's penmanship that Pepys admired? Or do you think it was the combination of the music that he heard with Davenant's text that clearly meant that he retained this information for us?
I think it is quite clear from Pepys's diary that he was carried away by the music. And it was something that he wanted to somehow reinstitute when he discovered that he couldn't actually find it. He sought the company of the people who'd been involved in the Siege of Rhodes when it was performed in Rutland House, in Davenant's house. It had obviously been a formative experience, and in a way he sought to reconstitute it.
So there's a portrait, isn't there, with a particular connection to Davenant?
The original is in the National Portrait Gallery, and the painting of it is described in the diary. And the wonderful thing is that now with X-rays, they've been able to follow the whole business through. And what Pepys was desperate to do was to get Hales to show Beauty Retire, which is what he's holding in his hand.
So there's a connection.
To show it adequately. And Hales was, because of for simple painterly reasons, looking at it from a rather different point of view. And Pepys went to great lengths to get him to turn it round, and all of this can be demonstrated from X-rays.
So we're stepping outside the library to have a look at the copy of this portrait hanging outside. So here it is, and there he's holding a copy of Beauty Retire, I see.
So that you can read the words, and indeed you could sing the music up to a point, though it's rather occluded there.
At first I thought her by our prophet sent, as a reward for valor's toils, more worth than all my father's spoils.
Davenant really specialised in sailing close to the wind.
Yes.
And obviously to do a musically staged play which got rid around the ban on stage plays because it was to music, and so it was interludes, and very careful to call them entries, not acts. If he'd said acts, then a play in five acts, it would have been a play. But an entertainment in five entries was something different again.
That's very politically astute, isn't it? That's someone who's learned a method of survival as an artist and an entrepreneur.
I think that Pepys probably lived with the regret that he had not actually found the music for the Siege of Rhodes to the very end of his life.
Well, let's hope we can provide something that he might be pleased to hear.
Well, and I do not believe it impossible that something might turn up You know, you never know.
What a tantalising idea, that the music to The Siege of Rhodes, the first English opera, might be sitting unidentified somewhere, gathering dust in someone's attic. After all, it was only 20 years ago that another Davenant-related document was discovered. This was a pamphlet entitled A Proposition for Advancement of Morality, and it appeared to answer a question that had long baffled theatre historians. How did the ultra-royalist Davenant manage to obtain permission from his seeming enemies, the Cromwellians, and put on an opera at perhaps the least propitious moment in the history of the English stage? One of the academic detectives responsible for making the discovery, Professor Tim Rayler, takes up the story from his base in Minnesota.
The document filled a bit of a biographical gap, a gap in our knowledge of what Davenant had been doing. Because Davenant had been arrested on his way to Maryland, where he'd been appointed lieutenant governor. He'd been taken by the Commonwealth authorities and thrown into prison. And he'd spent quite a bit of time in the Tower of London, where he was fearing execution. But then he'd been released, and we didn't really know very much about this period after his release. What was he actually up to, apart from being intermittently arrested for debt? And it became clear then from the document what he was up to. And what he was up to was trying to provide an intellectual and ideological rationale for the first English opera. Davenant doesn't use the word opera in A Proposition for Advancement of Morality, but it's clear from what he talks about that he's talking about the genre of work that he will later call opera. Now, the opera, he says, is going to render the people morally and politically virtuous. It's going to render them valiant abroad and compliant at home. And he bases the argument for how it's going to do this on a thoroughly mechanistic psychology, which he seems to have adapted from his reading of recent writings by the philosophers Thomas Hobbes and René Descartes, writings on the passions. And according to Davenant's version of this mechanist psychology, the common people, ordinary folk, are not truly rational, and they learn primarily through sense impressions. So the argument is that the way to educate the people is to work on their senses through powerful multimedia spectacles, which will relate politically correct stories of English martial valour and obedience to authority, through a powerful combination of words and music, visual spectacle with movable scenery and moving lights, transpositions of lights, with a view to indoctrinating the audience.
Tim Rayler of Carleton College, on the complex behind-the-scenes machinations that allowed Davenant's operatic experiment to go ahead. Back in London, the scene of Davenant's greatest triumphs,